We're closing in on the final episodes of season one, and I wanted to remind you that this thing does not happen without tension climbing. Not only do they make the best wooden training tools on the planet, but they also took a chance on a completely unproven podcast idea because they believe in the value of history and community. When you use the code STONE, that's STONE, for 10% off at tensionclimbing.com, you're letting them know how much you appreciate that support, and it helps us let them know that it was a good investment. So please, head to tensionclimbing.com, tell them thanks, and thank you for your support. Tensionclimbing.com, mastery over success. This is not a story about one important ascent. It's a story about a lot of ascents over many years. It's not a story about a person, but about a stone. Or, more precisely, a very small section of a much, much larger stone. A stone that enraptured many humans in a very small blip of a window in its much, much longer history. It's an examination of how we not only record, but how we edit that history, and of who gets credit for what. Because ultimately, the resulting route is one of the most famous in the world, up one of the most famous cliffs in the world, in a place that at one time was the epicenter of free climbing. And it deserves to have its story told, the whole story. And for that, we need to go back.
What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
Even before Warren Harding started up El Capitan in July of 1957, climbers had stared at the broad expanse of golden granite to the left of the nose. Yvon Chouinard had gone as far as naming the entire wall in honor of his valley hero, John Salathay. Wayne Mary had already spotted crack systems out there, and Chuck Pratt was fairly sure that those crack systems could connect into a potential route. When Harding succeeded on the nose in a siege that took 45 days over 18 months for the first ascent of El Capitan, Royal Robbins knew he had to respond, but in better style. He had repeated the nose, but that ascent was made much easier due to the massive number of bolts Harding and team had already pounded in. I've seen numbers ranging from 125 to 200, so just a lot. Robbins knew he would have to complete a route of his own to show what could be done. In September of 1961, Robbins and Tom Frost sat in the meadow with binoculars scanning that great golden wall, and as Robbins writes, came to the giddy conclusion that a magnificent route lay there. Days later, Robbins and Frost started up with the best crack climber in the valley, Chuck Pratt. Over a few days, they fixed ropes to Hart Ledge at about 800 feet, using 13 bolts to get through the blank, slabby walls down low. They then wrapped to the ground and rested for 3 days while they gathered equipment before prusiking back to the base of the Hart. Steve Roper, in his seminal book Camp 4, writes, "Then came the bravest act of all. Keeping just 3 ropes, the team hurled the others into the void. The umbilical cord had been severed." From September 18th to the 23rd of 1961, the trio pushed upward. No drama, no spectacle, and adding no more bolts. And topped El Cap via what would become known as the Salathay Wall. Royal Robbins would call it the finest rock climb on Earth. As Steve Roper writes, Harding pioneered the big wall concept. Robbins refined it. It was these two rivals, Harding and Robbins, polar opposites, who created the spectrum in which big wall climbers of the future would play. bending and breaking rules and inventing new ones to protect their ethics and their egos, all the while pushing higher and higher, culminating in a free climbable route that opened El Cap to more than just the elite climbers. And ironically, that route was first done by one of the most elite, one of the key players in the self-aggrandizing game of Yosemite Big Wall free climbing. Alexander Huber. I'm Chris Hampton. You're listening to Written in Stone, climbing's most important ascents. This is season one, the 1990s.
One, two.
In an interview with Pat Ament for his book, A History of Free Climbing in America, John Long says,
"You'll never get the history right on the free blast since there were about 10 of us involved."
In May of 1975, the initial 10 pitches of the Salathe Wall, or 11 depending on how you do it, where Robbins drilled the only bolts on the route, played host to a whole crew of stonemasters, including Backer, Calc, Bridwell, Long, and Mike Graham, all getting after it, trying to figure out how to free climb all the way to Mammoth Terrace. And through various efforts, the team had freed all but two pitches, a bolt ladder up high, and the third pitch, which had several pins and a small roof blocking the only handholds. Mike Graham, who, according to John Backer, was angry that Robbins had chopped some of Harding's bolts on the wall of early morning light, freed the bolt ladder and chopped Royal's bolts, eventually returning them to Robbins. Shortly after, Long and Backer went up to finish the third pitch. Long aided it, pulled the pins, and proceeded to free it at mid-5.11. The free blast was born, and it wouldn't take long before that effort enticed other free climbers further up the wall. 4 years, actually. In the fall of 1978, up-and-coming rock stars Mark Hudon and Max Jones were back east in New Hampshire. And while there, Jimmy Dunn mentioned to them that they should try to free the Salathe. They'd both already done the free blast and had aided the wall, so they had a good idea of what might stop them up there. And that thought stuck with them until the spring of 79 when they started up the route following their free-as-can-be tactic. Try to free things, but don't linger. If it's not going to go, just pull on gear and keep moving. With the exception of a short pendulum to Hollow Flake, which they didn't even consider trying to free as it would require bolts, they climbed all free to pitch 19, the double cracks above the ear, adding several new free pitches along the way. They did battle with this pitch 19, freeing all but four moves at the end. This pitch would later be a source of great speculation and controversy. But that's still coming. Stay with me. A couple of pitches later, and the team was on El Cap Spire. The two pitches above hadn't yet been freed, but they barely slowed Hudon and Jones down, checking in at 11C and 10D. After skipping past two short, tight corners that they figured would probably never go, they freed another new pitch, leading to Sous l'Etoile, and a couple of hard pitches just after it, bringing 512 to El Cap. This deposited the team below the fearsome, great roof of the Salathe. They gave the roof their best effort, freeing a fair bit of it, but were anxious to get to the headwall cracks. And those cracks didn't disappoint. Hudon believes that at the time, Max Jones was the best climber in the world. And so he took the lead up the first of the headwall cracks, freeing the majority of them, and while not clipping the anchor for a full free pitch, had done what ranked up there amongst the hardest pieces of climbing in the valley. Except this was at the top of El Capitan. In his 1981 article in Mountain Magazine, Long, Hard, and Free, Hudon writes,
"By the time we reached the top, we'd free-climbed all but 300 feet of the route. 100 feet of that only because it was wet. As we packed the bag for its quick trip down, I wondered if we'd done anything at all. Had we broken some mental barriers about free-climbing on walls? I know that some of the pitches we free climbed and attempted to free are the most radical climbing ever done on a wall. But for some reason, I was depressed, bummed out.
Maybe it's because that particular adventure was over. Maybe because he knew that it wouldn't be long before someone else freed the whole thing, the greatest rock climb on the planet. Or maybe simply because Mark knew that until somebody clips the chains and etches their name into the history books, the way we view the contributions of other climbers is to let their names fade into oblivion. And some certainly have. I've dug up what I can. In 1984, crack aces Alan Lester and Pat Adams made a quiet attempt, spending only a day and a half on the route, but freeing more of the aid remaining on the wall. A few years later, in 1987, German superstar Stefan Glowacz visited Yosemite with the goal of freeing the remainder of the Salathe. He trained obsessively for months to turn this dream into a reality. Full of nervous energy, but not quite sure what he was getting himself into, Glowacz started up the wall with a four-man team. On day one, they quickly climbed the free blast and explored the first unclimbed pitch, usually passed via a pendulum swing into Hollow Flake. Glowacz was sure he could make a down climb and traverse work, so he put bolts in and the team wrapped to the ground for one more night on terra firma. The next morning, after ascending the fixed lines, he fired the famous pitch first try at mid 512. With that success under his belt and the route now entirely free to the base of the 19th pitch, he was motivated to tackle that double crack corner, figuring he'd be through it by the end of the day. He was mistaken. The thin, flaring cracks had their way with him, and he never even got as close as Hudon and Jones had years earlier. Once he aided through, though, he reportedly freed it on top rope, but in the morning, when faced with the decision to continue on or give it a lead attempt, the team chose to continue on and maybe return to do the pitch later. But only a few pitches further up, they knew there would be no later. Stopped cold by the holdless groove now known as the Teflon Corner, all morale had disappeared. In his book, Rocks Around the World, Glowacz writes,
"It's easy to be wise after the event. I'm sure we were the first people to make a serious attempt to climb the Salathe free, but now I realize it was not serious enough. Arriving at the top, I had no stomach for the grand panorama. I just wanted to get down to a good meal and a sleep. Lots of sleep. Then I just wanted to slip away unnoticed from the scene of my humiliation."
El Cap had been drastically underestimated. But at this same time, there were two cowboys from Wyoming planning an attempt of their own. And rather than underestimate the big stone, they would bring to the valley a mountain of stubbornness and perseverance, along with flared crack climbing skills learned in Vitavu. They would also willingly dispense with many of the traditional tactics, opting instead to move the wall into the new era of free climbing. We'll be right back. Look, I love climbing, but I'm not a gearhead. I take one pair of shoes to the crag, I find a thing I like, and I stick with it until I'm forced to find something new. Hell, I basically eat the same thing every single day. So when I choose a tool to use in my climbing and training, I choose tools I trust. Which is why I have eight different tension climbing finger training tools. Because anytime they come out with a new innovative product, I know they thought long and hard about its purpose. They don't make things just to have a new product out. They make things to make us better climbers. From their shoe spray, to the hone stone, to the tension board too, it's all done with real intention. Yeah, shoe spray for fuck's sake. I didn't believe it either at first. Now, it's in my bag every single session. If you choose your tools based on trust, do your climbing a favor. Go to tensionclimbing.com, use the code STONE for 10% off, and to let them know you appreciate them supporting this project. That's STONE, STONE. Restrictions apply. Not valid for tension board sets, hardware, or gift cards. And cannot be combined with other offers. TensionClimbing.com. Mastery over success. In 1983, just as the efforts of Houdon and Jones on the Salathe were beginning to inspire other folks to make attempts, there was a team planning an assault up El Cap, just to the left of the Salathe. Steve Schneider and John Barbella would methodically pick their way up the route they would later call Bermuda Dunes, to the base of a long crack that starts as hands and ends as far too many feet of off-width climbing. Running it way out to get it done, Schneider called this monster off-width 510D. And so, when those cowboys, Todd Skinner and Paul Piana, reached the ear in 1988 and stared up at the double cracks of Pitch 19, they knew it was going to be hard. They'd heard its reputation, and had already planned to try to go around it via Steve Schneider's monster off-width out left. And they went as far as top-roping the off-width, but despite having honed their skills in vitavu, despised that style of climbing. In Big Walls, Paul writes,
"Since we were aesthetically repulsed by this vile crevice, we decided we would have our way with the original aid pitch, or else abandon the climb."
And have their way they did. While this pitch had been a stopper for other parties, it was no match for the experience Todd had built in establishing some of America's hardest thin cracks. At 13B, barely even slowed them down. But El Cap had another pitch waiting. The holdless groove that had stopped Glovach was resisting their attempts, as was the original aid line a few yards to the right, and the faces even further right. They just weren't finding a way. Maybe Houdon and Jones were correct that these pitches would just never go free. But like I said, persistence was their main asset. So they kept at it, Todd eventually finding the right combination of foot and palm pressure, body English, and belief to stay on the glassy walls long enough to make it through. And now, hold on. Let me step out of the story for a second here. It pains me to do this, but I just can't give you the entire saga of Skinner and Piana freeing the Salathe. That happens in 1988, a different season. And it certainly deserves an entire episode of its own. So I'm going to cut this part of the story grossly short and save it for another time. I can hear you grumbling, but trust me, there's a payoff coming. So the cowboys still had a fight on their hands, the headwall cracks. Glovach had told them it would never go. Houdon and Jones had done battle up there and made a good showing, but it still seemed next level. The headwall crack is long, flaring, and pumpy, perfectly splitting a shield of golden granite at the very top of the most famous big wall in the world. The stuff crack climber dreams, or nightmares, are made of. They gave it everything, held on for the ride, and emerged victorious. It was the first time the main wall of El Capitan had been climbed off free. And both climbers nearly died in the process. But like I said, that's a story for a different season. And you'd think everyone in Yosemite would then be chomping at the bit to get up on the wall and explore further. Instead, it was mostly grumbling at the tactics these outsiders had brought to one of their prized walls. Rumors flew that they couldn't possibly have done it. Most of the climbers standing on the ground were craning their necks to find any reason to disbelieve what had happened up high on El Capitan. But there were a few who were inspired. In 1992, already El Cap veterans Steve Schneider, Bill Price, and Jeff Schoen stood below Excalibur with their sights set on freeing it. Schneider had been on the route before, on aid, in 1983, but had gotten stormed off. Though, not before the geometry and architecture of the climbing got under his skin. Big, soaring off-widths, free from vegetation and water-worn for a millennia, made up the bulk of the route. He wasn't a slouch, and he knew these would be hard, among the hardest off-widths anywhere. So he trained hard and he went for it. The team ended up freeing 75% of the route. But most important for our story are the pitches leading off of a ledge called the Round Table, starting with pitch 23 of their route, an 11D double crack pitch led by Schoen, not far to the left of the infamous Salathay headwall cracks. And then, 3 years later, Alex Huber arrives in the valley. He'd grown up on a farm in a small village in Upper Bavaria, his father a climber who would climb nearly every major wall in the Alps and Dolomites, and his mother keen to spend as much time as possible hiking in the mountains. So Alexander and his older brother Thomas were at home in the Alpine. As they grew older, their climbing got better and bolder, and they began to make a name for themselves. As sport climbing entered the scene, they were perfectly poised. Heavily inspired by Wolfgang Gulich, they trained hard and climbed harder. Alex had recently done the first ascents of some of the first 9As in the world, and realizing that to climb harder sport climbs would require an immense time commitment, decided to follow a dream he'd had for some time. He'd seen a photo of those Salathay headwall cracks, and he needed to do them. But there weren't really cracks like that in the steep limestone he'd been immersed in. So he showed up in Yosemite with zero crack climbing experience. Incredibly, after just a couple of weeks of tutelage in Joshua Tree in Yosemite, he starts up the Salathay with a mix of free and aid to test his skills for a near future free attempt. He'd been hearing rumors about pitch 19, the fearsome double crack corner. He tried it, doing some of the moves, but guessing that it must be at least 13D. And so he assumed the rumors swirling around the valley must be true. If he couldn't do it, could Skinner have possibly done it? And from the ground, while glassing the wall, he had spotted that off-width out left, Schneider's from Bermuda Dunes, the same one Piana and Skinner had climbed and abandoned, and decided that he'd just climb the off-width at 10D or 11A instead of the double cracks at 13B. Triumphantly, he writes,
"With that, I had solved the crux."
Wait, hold on. Solved? I had to read that multiple times. I think he might have misspelled skipped. But I digress. Let's get back to the story. A few pitches later, he tried the Teflon corner, doing the moves, but again deciding it would be better to climb around it via a short pitch to the right. He added bolts to create this looping pitch, now known simply as the boulder problem, which was equally difficult, but in a style that suited him better. California's normally rain-free weather had flipped on him, and the deluge stopped him from attempting the headwall this time up. So he'd come back a few days later, solo, and wrap down the route to check out the 70-meter splitter. Several times up, for a couple of days at a time, working out the moves, marking the gear placements in chalk, and finally leading the pitches with Mark Chapman on belay, and he was ready for a full push. Twice more, the rain thwarted attempts, and a day after climbing the free blast and being stormed off, Huber started up the fixed lines to Hart Ledge under clear skies. Over the next 2 days, accompanied by Heinz Zach and Mark Chapman, Huber climbed his easier variation of Piana and Skinner's free Salathay, again skipping the crux 19th pitch and the Teflon corner, laying the groundwork for what would come a few years later. As he was leaving the valley, he called climbing magazine editor Jeff Aki from a Yosemite payphone to report on his accomplishment. In his article, Aki writes,
"He says he looks forward to returning to Yosemite and evades mischievously when asked about future projects there."
It would take 3 years, but the reason for his evasion would eventually become clear. We'll be right back. What's up, everybody? I just wanted to drop in here to say thank you. Projects like this take way too many hours to make, and it just doesn't happen without your support. So whether it's training plans, courses, or products, it's your support of Power Company Climbing, as well as our sponsors here on this show, that has given me the time and motivation to conceptualize and create things like this podcast. So as a thank you, we're offering 20% off of almost everything on our site. Finger files, clippers, apparel, proven plans, ebooks, courses, and more. For details, go to powercompanyclimbing.com/stone. And then use the code STONE, that's STONE, at checkout. Powercompanyclimbing.com. Learn, grow, excel. When Alex Huber was alone up there on the Salathe headwall working out the moves and gear placements, he noticed something interesting. To the left, he could see cracks, and they looked considerably easier. Skinner and Piana had noticed these as well and kept them in their back pocket in case they weren't able to free the headwall pitches. Self-belayed with a soloist device, Huber found a way to traverse into these cracks and climbed to the top first try, realizing that combined with the monster off-width below, he could effectively skip all of the cruxes of the Salathe wall. But after his ascent of the free Salathe variation, he had trouble finding a belayer, and he had another trip already planned. So he kept quiet about the variation he'd seen. 3 years later, in 1998, he returned with his brother Thomas, who'd come the year before and attempted the Salathe himself, though opting not to climb the monster off with like his brother had, and instead trying Piana and Skinner's Pitch 19. He sort of succeeded, but like nearly every ascent of the route, this one has a complicated asterisk attached to it as well. Collectively known as the Huberbaum, Huber boys in their Bavarian dialect, the two got right to work, first establishing a nearly free variation of the North America wall, El Nino, which was the first extensive free climbing on the foreboding right side of El Cap. And if it hadn't been for a short rappel that they did by using their own bodies as anchors, would have been the third entirely free route on the Big Stone. After this, they would execute Alex's vision from his time on the Salathe. And they would do so in perfect style. 3:31 a.m. The Huber brothers leave the ground, delicately making their way up the free blast, the slabs first freed by the Stone Masters in 1975. And they soon reach Mammoth Terrace and the down climb to Heart Ledge. And there's a tricky move off of Heart Ledge, first freed by Hudon and Jones in 1979. And this leads eventually to the long down climb and traverse into Hollow Flake that Stefan Glovach had pioneered in 1987. Moving quickly through the unprotectable pitch above and past more of what Hudon and Jones had first freed, they're following the free Salathe until they reach the Ear, about halfway up the wall, and only a little over 6 hours into the day. Here, they make a short traverse left, as Alex had done previously, into Steve Schneider's monster off-width on the route Bermuda Dunes. This pitch takes them an hour to do, but allows them to skip the first crux of the free Salathe, and they rejoin the route just below El Cap Spire. 11 a.m. The monster was tiring, so they take a 20-minute break on El Cap Spire. And then they're off again, starting up through two sandbagged 511 pitches first free climbed by Hudon and Jones. Where Skinner and Piana's free Salathe takes the Teflon corner, the Hubers again opt for Alex's bolted variation, the boulder problem pitch, both options avoiding the original aid line, which goes straight up the middle, and both options coming in at around 12D. The brothers know the moves well and dispatch it readily. 3 p.m. They climb through the easier but wet and slimy terrain now known as the sewer, which leaves them standing on a small ledge known as the block. And this begins a string of groundbreaking pitches first done by Hudon and Jones on that 1979 as free as can be push, including the excellent exposed pitch to Sous la Toile. The pitches above Sous la Toile, known now as the Enduro Corners, are again Hudon and Jones' masterpieces, the first 512s ever climbed on El Cap. 4 p.m. The Hubers are under the Great Roof. was here that 3 years earlier, Alex Huber had seen an unlikely, somewhat wandering traverse to the left. Even though the giant roof looming above is intimidating, it also works to reduce the exposure. It evokes a feeling that the climber is not just on the wall, but a part of it, in it. And up to this point, most of the route has been this way, tucked into the safety of corners and surrounded by big granite walls. The overwhelming size of El Cap becomes something of a security blanket. But as Thomas, who's taken the lead, traverses left and turns the corner, out of sight from the belay, he's suddenly alone. The pitch is only 12A and follows a mostly juggy rail, but he's moved out of the corners and for a moment is tiny and misplaced, adrift in a massive sea of granite, the ground relentlessly tugging at him from 2,500 feet below. It's tremendously exposed, and it's fantastic. Thomas, who loves moving over stone as intensely as anyone, smiles all the way across the 70-foot traverse and is deposited on Round Table Ledge at the base of Pitch 23 of Excalibur, the 11D double cracks that Jeff Schoen had led in 1992. Few more crack pitches from the near-free Excalibur push, including what later became known as the Scotty Burke off-width, and the Hubers rejoin the Free Salathe for its final few easier pitches. 6:30 p.m. With the Sierra light fading, Alex climbs the final pitch and belays Thomas to the tree that marks the stopping of the clock. Both brothers had free-climbed each of the 37 pitches in 15 hours and 25 minutes, only the second time El Cap had been free-climbed in a day. A great accomplishment, no question, a seminal moment. But the real hero of the day is that 12A traverse discovered by Huber 3 years earlier. Truly a stroke of genius for the burgeoning El Cap free climbing scene, it allowed the Hubers to skip the hard headwall pitches of the Salathe wall. And in doing so, would open El Cap to climbers who weren't quite at that elite level, those who weren't regularly climbing mid-513. Suddenly, with the establishment of that 65 feet of sideways granite smearing, a schoolteacher in Wichita, Kansas could realistically dream of free climbing El Capitan. All because of one person, Alexander Huber. Now, knowing what we know about the long history of the route, I can't help but think that the way we credit or edit things, what then becomes history, is just, in many ways, unjust. And I want to be clear here. I'm not trying to take anything away from the Hubers. What they did is undeniable. But if we open up the facts beyond just who did the thing first, the Hubers pioneered approximately 1/30th of the route. Less than 100 of the 3,000 total feet. First, the boulder problem pitch, which is basically an alternate way to do the crux. And at first, this is how all of the freerider repeaters did the route. But partly because Huber himself set the precedent that the climber can choose which pitch they prefer and still claim to have done the route, and partly because the boulder problem has broken and gotten harder, many people now skip it in favor of the Teflon corner. Second, and most important by far, is that 12A traverse to Round Table Ledge. Freerider is a link-up, a short traverse to connect two different already established routes. And I love link-ups, but they just don't get the same sort of respect as a more pure, emphatic air quotes here, route does. And for that reason, I don't like simply relegating freerider to link-up status, even though it factually is. But I also can't feel good about crediting the route the same way we do when someone establishes an entirely new route. And I suppose I should put new route in those same emphatic air quotes, as that's pretty rare in the big wall free climbing world. But when Lynn Hill did the nose, yes, other people laid the groundwork, a lot of it, but she was the first to do the hardest pitches. Same with Todd and Paul on the Free Salathe. And while researching this, I've asked several people why we credit these roots the way we do, and the common refrain is that there just isn't room in the guidebooks. But I'm not buying that answer, not least of which because guidebooks aren't the only place this happens. It happens on websites and magazines and basically everywhere the history is recorded. But even if we look just at the guidebooks, they often do include some FA history. For a while, it was a trend in sport climbing guides to credit the entire party that was there for the bolting, cleaning, working moves, and sending. I've seen single-pitch climbs in guidebooks with four or five first ascensionists. Emphatic air quotes again. Many guidebooks still credit the equipper of a route, which I think is a nice touch, but can lead to its own problems. When I talked with Adam Andra earlier this season about Just Do It and how we credit first ascents in sport climbing, he pointed out the expansive gray area there as well.
I think it is maybe a bit of a shame that all the media attention focuses on the person who actually ends up making the first ascent. I think it would be nicer to have something like a team ascent. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes if you both end up sending it in the similar period of time, I think it should kind of remain unknown who ends up sending it or not. Who ends up like sending it first, you know?
Yeah.
It often happened to me that I'm traveling all over the world and I just made first ascents of so many open projects, and some open projects were just ready to be climbed. The person already put a lot of effort into cleaning it and getting the route ready, whereas sometimes placing the bolts is maybe only 10% of the work.
Right.
And cleaning it and making it good takes much more time. So I would say it's individual.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And you know, some lines are just epic. I don't know, like Biography in Seyus. That line is just so obvious that, and the rock is so perfect that placing the bolts into it takes like 3 hours. And if you don't do it, thousands and thousands of other people would do it probably sometime later.
Yeah.
Whereas like some routes are absolutely epic.
Yeah.
But the line is super amazing when you look at it when it's finished. But before it was bolted, it's not really clear where it goes. And I would say Just Do It is somewhere in between. I think it is so inviting to climb like right in the middle of that face. But I think finding the perfect line in the middle of this blank looking wall is not so easy and not so obvious.
Now, obviously we were discussing sport climbing here, but I suspect that's the lens through which most of the climbing community understands climbing. And Freerider sort of fits into both sides of Adam's argument. Establishing the Salathe, and then again as a free route, was epic, requiring many years, advancements in tactics, and massive effort from several parties. It's a mostly obvious line, but there are blank sections that needed to be approached creatively. And the creative approach that allowed Freerider to happen, that 12A traverse, well, that vision was all Alex Huber. Since finishing the Akira episode, I've tried very hard to divorce from this story my disappointment in what I learned about Huber in that story. And to be perfectly honest, I haven't done a good job of it. I've waffled on whether to try to ignore it or make it the focus. It's impossible to read about his ascent of Freerider without his ascent of the Free Salathe, which he spends a wild amount of time claiming is the first real ascent, even though he skipped the crux. It seems obvious to me that there's a giant ego at play, and after reading several of his books, I suspect he wouldn't dispute that. But it doesn't have to be black and white. It's not ignore it or focus on it. It's part of the story, and it shouldn't be ignored. but it's also not the main focus of the story. So it's just become what it seems nearly every big wall free ascent has attached to it, an asterisk. And so the conclusion I've come to is that within the rules of the game that was being played, essentially being invented on El Capitan, the most grand of arenas, starting in the late 80s through the 90s and extending to today, the Hubers should get the credit. They had the vision, and they executed it decisively. There's no ambiguity about their first ascent of Freerider. Climbing from the ground to the top, the first people to red point every pitch, done astonishingly in a single day. It's just a fact. However, if there's one thing I've learned this season, it's that none of the hardest routes and boulders get done at the time they did without the collaboration or competition from other climbers. Gibe Tribou sparking Lynn Hill to climb 514, Milan Sikora bolting action direct and handing it to Wolfgang, Ben Moon putting effort into Hubble because other people were gunning for it as well, Skinner putting a Trango team together because Wojtek Kortyka told him he could free climb the tower. Freerider is no different, but also it is. Of all of the seminal routes that came together in the 1990s, pushing climbing forward into the new millennium, Freerider represents the best opportunity to recognize this collaboration. Clear-cut pieces and pitches pioneered by climbers past, and most importantly, blank spaces left for climbers of the future to realize their visions. First, it doesn't happen without Robbins, Frost, and Pratt, spurred on by Harding, to drastically reduce the bolt count and instead follow the weaknesses up the wall. And it doesn't happen without the contributions of everyone who went up there and freed the 29 or 30 other pitches. The Stone Masters on the free blast. Mike Graham freeing the bolt ladder and John Long removing the old pins to create a free pitch, encouraging free climbers to venture up the wall to begin with. Glovach for the creative solution to get around the pendulum to Hollow Flake. Steve Schneider on the monster off with, and with Jeff Schoen and Bill Price doing those pitches off of the round table ledge on Excalibur. Frankly, Piana and Skinner for being the first to bring real sport climbing tactics to the wall and for having the wherewithal to document their ascent, inspiring one of the world's best sport climbers to make the trip to Yosemite Valley for those soaring splitter headwall cracks. And of course, Mark Hudon and Max Jones, who, way ahead of their time, climbed the vast majority of what would become Piana and Skinner's free Salathe, then later Huber's variation, and then finally, Freerider. It's just a fact. And we, the community, the climbers, the guidebook authors, the storytellers, the writers and shapers of history, get to choose how we credit or edit those facts. And even if the truth, emphatic air quotes one more time, only lives here on this podcast and on obscure websites that we can only find on the Wayback Machine and through stories told at campfires and at the crag, at least it lives.
One, two.
Written in Stone is produced by me, Chris Hampton, with help from Riley Rush and Emily Holland for Plugtone Audio, a group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. At the link in your show notes, you'll find all the things you expect and probably some you don't, like how you can become a member of the Secret Stoners Club, where you'll find bonus materials and bonus episodes. And look, this show is 100% rooted in the facts, but like Todd Skinner always said, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And seriously, if you love what you're hearing, give us those 5 stars and a glowing review. The algorithm loves it, which means more people find it, which means sponsors love it, which means we can make a season 2, and together we can tell the stories of climbing's most important ascents, 1 decade at a time. Written in Stoners. I have an apology. I just listened back to the Mike Lilligren episode, Secret Stoners Club. And first off, wow, I am a rambler. How do you all listen to all of that? I do not know. And number two, I totally told you that this episode you just listened to was coming the next Monday. And I knew it wasn't. I knew we were playing that episode from The Struggle, but in my head, I was still on Written in Stone time. So I apologize for that. I eventually delivered. I just delivered a week late. Congrats to Tom Giorgio and Jeremy Katz. They were the Secret Stoner Club winners of the Tension Block giveaway and the organic skincare bundle and the Proven Plan. So we're having more giveaways soon. Stay tuned for those. But congrats, guys. I appreciate you. And also, I appreciate our newest rock stars. We've got quite a few. David, Kevin Walter, Brian Rosenthal, and Britt Crawford, who slipped in just 30 minutes before I was recording this. So I appreciate all of you. And just, wow, thank you for all of the support. I am deep into the final episode of the season now, and it's very bittersweet. But I'm going to tell you about that later, because this episode that you just heard left me very conflicted. Does it seem like I've been conflicted a lot at the end of this season? I have. I actually went through a lot of emotions writing this episode, and this episode went through a lot of iterations. And that's because I don't like bullies. You know, the first two fights I ever got into were with bullies. And they were not the last two bullies that I got into fights with. What we learned in the Fred Ruling episode and how Alex Huber treated Fred Ruling and Barnaby Fernandez and then Todd and Paul. Alex Huber's a bully. I don't like it. But that doesn't mean I can erase him from history. And here's the very abbreviated whole story. In our very first list for what the season was going to be, I think I listed out like 25 or 30 ascents from the 90s, and we whittled that down to 10, and Alex Huber did not make the cut. Because there wasn't a really important ascent of his, it was always the second of the grade or the third of the grade or something like that. And I was okay with that until I started researching what the first 9A might have been, and that Alex Huber was right there in the running, and he seemed to be popping up in all these places. So I'm like, I can't take him out of this season entirely. So I announced, okay, we're going to do 11 episodes instead of 10. And in my head, one of those was Alex Huber, and it was going to be one of his sport routes. But then I hit on the idea of free rider, because it's this monumental moment. It shifted the big wall free climbing culture in a really important way. And then I wrote the Fred Ruling Akira episode, and I'm like, I don't want to include this guy in the season at all. So I had to do a lot of thinking. And like I said, this episode went through a bunch of iterations. I think I landed in a place that I'm happy with, that I can't change history. It is what it is. I'm not trying to edit it in any certain way, but I do want to tell the full history. And I think that the way we the way we credit people and the way we engage with the history is very often to forget a lot of the history in favor of one clear, concise line in a guidebook. And I didn't want that to be the case here. So that's where I landed. You don't have to like it. You can be all for Alex Huber gets all the credit for Free Rider, and that's all there is to it. That's the way it works. And that's fine. You're entitled to your opinion, as am I. And as is our guest, who I'll be talking to next Monday. He is a good friend of mine. It was a really fun conversation. He talked me off the ledge multiple times. And actually, he was very instrumental in the final iteration of this episode. And that will be the OG podfather himself, Chris Caluse. See you then.